From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The situation keeps developing on the ground in Syria, with Russia's president and the president of Turkey meeting in Sochi, Russia, and the calls at home for President Trump's head over attempting to make peace there becoming more and more shrill. For today's report, we talk Turkey with Mark Sloboda, the international analyst based in Moscow. We spoke with him via Skype from Russia on Tuesday.
Don, thanks for having me on. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
It's our honor and pleasure to host you. You know, it's an interesting moment in this Syrian war. It's certainly been an interesting few weeks looking at the way it's kind of shaping up. You can almost see the end from here, at least maybe it's a mirage, but it looks like the sketch, you know, the skeleton of a settlement is kind of coming into shape with the Syrian government at its own borders with Turkey. Turkey not crossing them, we hope. I'm not sure how that's actually going to play out, but if Syria gets possession of all of its land, you know, it has its business to settle with its Kurds, you know, themselves. That's been kind of a conversation that's been going on a long time. And if Turkey's going to respect the borders, I don't know what else is there to settle still.
Yeah, I don't. That's. I don't see any of that happening.
Oh, bummer, bummer. Oh man, you're a killjoy. Jeez.
Yeah, sorry.
Buzzkill.
Since Trump unexpectedly, after a telephone conversation with Erdogan, announced the withdrawal of U.S. forces, not even 2 weeks ago now. We certainly have seen big changes in East Syria, in the balance of power as it was in the region and throughout Syria as a whole, and on a bigger picture, even throughout the Middle East. This marks big changes. And while Trump was announcing the withdrawal, the Russian president was basically being feted as a visiting czar in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, showcasing again the increased importance of Russia in the Middle East. It's not a situation where the U.S. is not in the Middle East or has left the Middle East,
right,
but that it has retreated somewhat from its attempted fully hegemonic position.
Right.
It had attempted to overthrow the Syrian government and then occupy eastern Syria as a spoiler when that failed. And now it seems to largely being withdrawing from that and recognizing that it can't extend its control of the Middle East into Syria. And that failure has opened the way for Russian influence and the situation where the Mideast's main powers, be it countries like Iran, who are friendly with Russia, or Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, who have much more tenuous relations, have to respect that Russia is again a player in the region. And it is more of a return to, multipolar politics writ small in the Middle East, with U.S. and Russia still being the largest, now being the largest outlier players, but both having a say in it.
Russia is less of an outlier, of course. You know, Trump himself mentions that 7,000 miles away thing a few times, and Russia is by no means 7,000 miles away from here.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that has long been part of Russia's calculus of intervening in Syria in 2015, is that the northeast corner of Syria is less than 24 hours by jeep
right.
away from southern Russia.
Right. For ISIS types or whatever,
yes.
if they decide, let's go someplace else, that's a place yeah. they can infect by car,
well,
like within a
day. There's no question that there were several thousands, somewhere between 3 and 5, depending on who was counting, Russian citizens, right,
right.
in Syria fighting with the jihadists.
Right.
They were of all various Wahhabist sorts, be
right.
they Chechens, Ingush, right. Dagestani, right. right? So on, there were from 3,000 to 5,000, right. you know, Russian citizens there. And Russia adopted the approach that, well, we have to go and kill them there to prevent them from coming back
right.
and restarting an attempt to form an Islamic caliphate or an emirate, as it's called, an Islamic emirate in southern Russia along the Caucasus.
Right.
You know, the old American calculation of best fight them there than at home.
Right.
So that has long been part.
Before we go too far off, just could you maybe give us a lay of the land status quo ante of 2 weeks ago? In other words, when Trump had the phone call, what was the status of things on the ground then? I want to make sure we cover that, you know, before we get too deep.
Yeah. Yeah. So, before that phone call took place, we were in a three-way Mexican standoff in Syria with the Syrian the Russian intervention having helped secure the Syrian government, along with help from Iran and Hezbollah, such that Damascus wasn't threatened, but did not and had control of the largest chunk territorially wise of Syrian territory, having recovered a lot of territory, but also had control of the close to 75%, maybe even 80% of the population of Syria. That was one side of the equation. A second side of the equation was Turkey and their various jihadi proxies, which had been delegated in two big groups at this point. All of the former, quote, moderate rebel groups, unquote, from the Free Syrian Army to Jaish al-Islam to Ahrar al-Sham, all the 31 flavors of jihad had essentially been relegated to Turkish support and control. Trump, for the most part, had the U.S. Policy of Obama's CIA of supporting the jihadists stop, for the most part. Jordan dropped out of it. Russia talked Saudi Arabia out of it, talked Qatar out of it, talked Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates. And so it was down to basically Turkey for the most part. There may be
right.
some small funds going from other countries, but they are consolidated. And Turkey had consolidated most of these forces for the first time in this conflict in one unified force. And this they rebranded as the Syrian National Army.
Right.
This... according to Turkey's accounts, this is 80,000 forces strong. That the 80,000 rebel, jihadi proxies, ready to do Turkey's bidding, more or less,
right.
In Syria. The only major factions not part of the Syrian National Army were essentially holding the fort down in Idlib, having essentially taken over control of Idlib. They had actually fought forces, other Turkish-backed forces before, and that is Al-Qaeda, now rebranding itself for the third or fourth time in this conflict as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, along with their close allies, the Turkestan Islamic Party, and Haras al-Din, which is basically like Al-Qaeda on steroids.
Before the change with Turkey and the sort of filtering of the Saudis and the other Emirates out of there, a lot of these groups were the projects of, say, the Saudis or the Qataris,
yes.
or whomever,
yes.
and they end up with no patron, and so they sort of modify themselves into this Turkish force.
Yeah, they're kind of separate. Turkey has long been trying to herd them to kind of officially don the Turkish proxy uniform. Right. They've been resisting. They have fought for local control, petty politics, and leadership struggles, you know, not any big ideological struggles with the other Turkish-backed groups. HTS has always come out on top, you know, Al-Qaeda, and they still do receive Turkish support. That's important to note. Daily convoys from Turkish territory of ammunition, food, gasoline, and so on. But they do retain a higher degree of, shall we say, autonomy or remove from the Erdogan regime in Turkey. So they're not always as cooperative as Turkey would like.
Now, ISIS didn't beam up to the Enterprise, okay? So those folks are, you know, herded around, you know, the fighters in those groups are herded around the remaining fighting groups as well. Where are they located?
Yeah, okay, so ISIS no longer technically has any territorial caliphate between Syria and Iraq. Unofficially, there's still swaths of desert in the east of Syria and the west of Iraq, where the general consensus, particularly in western Iraq, that ISIS is attempting to regroup, and where they still have, you know, control, you know, over small outlying settlements and so on, although, you know, it may be more of a nomadic type thing at this point, a guerrilla, you know, an insurgency. They, of course, the Turkish Syrian National Army contains, you know, no small number of former Al-Qaeda and ISIS members among its own ranks.
Right.
They've co-opted various groups, you know, plenty of time. But so does the U.S.-controlled Syrian Democratic Forces in East Syria. That force, a recent study by the Wilson Center actually found that the Syrian Democratic Forces, this was just a few weeks ago, they claim that the Syrian Democratic Forces, which the name is already starting to fall out of use, was at the time of this signing only about 40% Kurdish now. And then it was actually about 60% local Eastern Arab tribes.
Right.
Not as coherent, probably not as well trained, but, you know, existing at least on paper in some type of form of cooperation with the U.S., somewhat resentful of the Kurds, it must be said. Right. And no small number of those tribes had once had, at least nominal adherence to ISIS, because right, that was East Syria where ISIS had its caliphate. And some right, of it was deal with the devil. Some of it was, in order to survive. Some of it was, you know, genuine sympathies and so on. But right, Syrian Democratic Forces had plenty of tribes that formerly owned allegiance to ISIS. That is, you know, something that is only talked about deep in the literature and only marginally nodded at, but it is a truism.
Right.
That is what is under Turkey's control. Turkey controlled Idlib, essentially under its influence through Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And that is where the Syrian government and Russia are still actively engaged with the proxy, with the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and the Turkestan Islamic Party on the ground, bombing, taking, they had at this point taken a good chunk of southern Idlib and the surrounding areas back for the government, including the former small city of Khan Shaykhun, where this infamous fake chemical attack on Al-Qaeda controlled territory gave Trump the excuse to launch a token, although ineffectual, cruise missile attack in Damascus a couple years ago. They also, the Turks, more directly control the entire stretch of territory between Afrin, which was once a western Kurdish canton, of Rojava, as they called it, all the way through the Jurablus corridor to the Euphrates River. So essentially the whole stretch of northern Syria west of the Euphrates, with the exception of Latakia, right on the coast, to a good depth of up to 25 to 30 miles, and Idlib more, was controlled by Turkey, and is controlled by Turkey at this moment. There's lots of complaints from the Kurds and from human rights groups that Erdogan has engaged in large-scale ethnic cleansing of Kurds from Afrin, and he's resettling all of these fighters and their families in this Jurablus corridor area and Afrin. He's not going anywhere anytime soon. I've seen pictures of branded Turkish national post offices opening on Syrian territory, right? Turkish national post offices,
right,
with the Turkish national post office branding. I've seen the Syrian schools that have been reopened flying the Syrian rebel and the Turkish flags, right? So that should give you some idea of his intentions there.
Right.
Now, that was the situation. And Turkey was extremely unhappy, of course, with the Syrian government, which they refused to negotiate directly with, at least certainly not on the presidential level. And they still continue to regard as illegitimate. They were also extremely unhappy with the U.S. Trump administration's doubling down on support for the Syrian Kurds, the creation of a de facto Syrian, a Kurdish autonomous state, under the rubric of the Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF, in eastern Syria under U.S. Protection, control. And that brings us to the third partner in the Mexican standoff, which was the U.S. occupation force, along with several hundred European troops from other European countries, UK, France, and a few others. And the Syrian Democratic Forces, again, some 80,000 strong, probably around 40 to 50% of which were Kurds, former YPG. These three forces, and of course they were sitting on top of Syria's major oil reserves in the east, and Syria's fertile wheat growing area, essentially helping starve the majority of the population of the country as well. Everything east of the Euphrates. And so this three-way Mexican standoff has lasted for almost a year and a half, closing on 2 years now.
Right.
Until Trump's phone call with Erdogan. And there he seems to have been rolled by Erdogan to some extent, Erdogan complaining that he's supporting terrorists and some extent manipulated into following what has long been Trump's own position. He has wanted to get out of Syria. He sees it not out of any international legal or moral standpoint, but simply that it's expensive and there's no direct benefit to the United States as he sees it for the U.S. to be involved there. So he has pushed for that several times now. The U.S., the bureaucracy, the deep state, if you will, the Pentagon, the CIA, both houses of Congress included, have always pushed back. And he's given up shortly after announcing it twice before. This time, he not only announced it, but he had told Erdogan, and Erdogan immediately announced that he was coming across the border after having threatened to do so. Now he basically claimed that with the U.S. troops withdrawing, that he had been given a green light to do so by Trump. Trump administration denied that, but de facto, they certainly did. The Pentagon and the entire political class in D.C., both houses of Congress, immediately condemned Trump, abandoning our allies as if the U.S. was in eastern Syria to build a Kurdish protectorate. I mean, I did I miss?
No,
where
no.
Congress approved the invasion, occupation, and creation of a Kurdish mini state in East Turkey.
Or the UN Security Council, by the way, since the U.S. Congress doesn't have the authority to do that, you know, in terms of any Syrian land.
Well, I mean, we know the U.S. doesn't pay any attention to international law, but this was never even the mission of U.S. forces in eastern Syria. You know, and that's we all know that's just another excuse. The U.S. is there to prevent the Syrian government from reforming and stabilizing, and in their minds to prevent Iranian influence and Russian influence.
They're a guarantor of the status quo. Also, just having U.S. troops there meant, you know, no one could blow up the U.S. troops. Basically, so
yeah, the status quo of destabilization.
Right, everything else is frozen in place or in motion. Whatever.
Actually, it worked the other way. The presence of U.S. troops prevented anyone from blowing up the Kurds. But
that's right. That's right. That's exactly what. And so, as soon as he tells Erdogan they're coming out, he's like, "Get the bombs," you know. And that was he wasn't even shy about it.
Turkey was across the border in less than 48 hours in East Syria.
Yep.
Now, the Turkish.
Well, hold on. One last thing before we get there. Yep. So, it's just the final part of the setup. So, we end up with three players. One of them is Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah. Operating Syrian. In conjunction with the Syrian Arab Army, in other words. So now we have a military alliance that's fighting together, in essence, of those four elements for the first time ever. This was created as a reaction to what the U.S. was doing in Syria at the request, you know, basically maybe on hands and knees of the Syrian government, and which means it's basically a product of the Obama administration. They are responsible for this alliance that now exists, this battle-tested military alliance that now exists in the Middle East that's led by Russia. Secondly, you have Turkey and the situation that you described in some considerable detail. And again, Turkey's presence in Syria is a byproduct of the U.S. deciding that there should be a war in Syria back in 2011.
Starting with a proxy war, only going to a direct invasion and occupation of East Syria when the proxy war failed.
Which left U.S. troops on the ground in one fashion or another with their guns pointed at a NATO ally for the first time in history, also a product of the Obama administration. And then finally, the situation where they were, if nothing else, referee between a NATO ally and the Kurds in a battle that they more or less set up the conditions for, at least in this particular round, and again, a product of the Obama administration. So all of that is what Trump comes into office with, going on the ground in Syria, with the possibilities of every one of them blowing each other up, and with Turkish NATO planes having shot down Russian planes already, you know, the possibility of a larger war being started. That's what he starts with 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, and I mean, there's such contradictions in the U.S. position in Syria that it was always kind of doomed to either failure or a conflagration of Syria, if not the entire region.
Right.
I mean, Obama, along with Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey and Israel and everyone else,
right,
was supporting jihadi proxies in the country.
Right.
And that was through the CIA.
Right.
Meanwhile, the Pentagon had started supporting the Kurds primarily to fight ISIS, but the Kurds were not fighting the Syrian government. They were, however, fighting the U.S. and Turkish-backed Free Syrian Army.
So we had the Pentagon at war with the CIA on the ground.
CIA-backed jihadis fighting Pentagon-backed Kurds in northeast Syria during the Obama administration, a proxy war between U.S. government institutions.
I dare say that's the first time in history. I dare say that's the first time in history that happened also, and that happened during the Obama administration. Yes.
So Trump knocked off most of that, but doubled down on support for the Kurds, which was always an untenable position because both Turkey, a fellow NATO ally supposedly, and Iraq were extremely against an autonomous Kurdish protectorate or statelet forming in East Syria because of the demonstrative effect it would have on their own Kurdish minorities.
Right.
Again, Trump, this was stated by U.S. officials, the Trump admin, you know, and it was always true. The U.S. was never going to sacrifice relations with Turkey, with a NATO member, or more even fight Turkey over a Kurdish nation building project in East Syria. It was just never going to happen. And if the right. Kurds believed that, they, you know, if they were so naive to believe that after how many times America has thrown the Iraqi Kurds under the bus, I don't right. know what to say. Well, I can only assume that some of the Kurdish YPG elite were receiving rather comfortable checks right. from the Americans, right. and that made them overlook, you know, the obvious perils to their own national position.
The Syrian version of the Barzanis, maybe.
I can't understand. Yeah, I can't, because I can't understand such stupidity of understanding the political and the geopolitical situation. So I think, and it very nearly led to disaster for their people.
You mentioned one other thing in there that's, I think, extremely key. And you kind of just went through it because you're familiar with it, but people don't know this either, and it's something that you must know considering that point. The entire time this whole thing is going on, the Kurds are negotiating more or less for a post-war peace with Damascus. In other words, you know, we may well end up with an autonomous republic inside Syria, and so we want to work and coordinate with Damascus so we don't get to a point where we can't have those kinds of discussions. And in fact, while we have some leverage, let's start having the discussions now. And that was kind of going on in the background, too.
It was, but it had actually been pushed to the back burner, I think, very stupidly by the Kurds. At one point, they had far more leverage.
Well, came around.
Now we come to this phone call where Trump is announcing right. the withdrawal. And it has to be said, in the last 48 hours, anonymous people within the administration are contacting newspapers and saying that the Trump is considering, i.e. they're pushing, for the U.S. to keep several hundred troops in Syria
right.
sitting on Syria's oil fields
right.
Further south from the area of the Turkish incursion
right.
in order to guard the oil fields from ISIS
right.
and others who may benefit from
it. Like the Syrians, for example.
Well,
and you got to hurry because we only have 2 minutes.
The U.S. is also always going to remain in southern Syria
right.
at this isolated desert base at Al-Tanf, which nonetheless still sits on important trade highways south to Jordan,
right.
which is crucial for Syria's economy. So they were always going to remain there as well.
Right.
Now we come to this fateful decision, so opposed by almost the entirety of the U.S. blob political elite.
2 minutes. You got 2 minutes.
Yeah, 2 minutes to withdraw. And again, it's not a fait accompli. So Turkey surged across the border, but only in an area of eastern Syria between two towns in the only Arab-majority area of north Syria there, where the rest is dominated by the Kurds. This is Sunni Arab-majority, so not as opposed to the Turkish presence, between Tel Abyad and Ras Alim. And this area and a rectangular stretch down to an important highway is the only territory that the Turks now control. There was a kind of a bull feces agreement between the U.S., which has no real leverage anymore as they're pulling out, or at least most of their troops, and Turkey to have a ceasefire, which Turkey never regarded as a ceasefire, in order for the Kurdish YPG, formerly the Syrian Democratic Forces, to move out of this area. And to some extent, it looks like they're complying. But at the same time, the Kurds have stuck at least a nascent agreement with the Syrian government and Russia to move Syrian government troops up to the border in other areas. And it seems like that's happening.
Yeah, so
right now,
it
seems
yes.
that Erdogan is going to keep the small chunk he's taken in East Syria. And
right.
and what he still has in West Syria, it's going to settle down into a Turkish protectorate and a frozen conflict. And Russia's going to hope to raise the costs economically, politically, and hope that within a few years, Turkey pulls out of their own cord, having exhausted their Erdogan's neo-Ottoman ambitions for influence in northern Syria and leverage over Damascus. But we'll see where that goes. My prediction, frozen conflict.
Beautiful. And we'll come back to that and see what happens just in the next week, because I'm sure it's not going to even stay frozen that long. Mark, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.